You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey, this is Lurk here. Thanks for checking out Lamb Goats, the Van Flip podcast. If this is your first time checking out the podcast, or if you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a rating and a review on whatever platform you're listening to us on. Those definitely help us out with the algorithm in the podcast world. Also, if you want to go ahead and share this podcast with a friend of yours, please do so. You never know. You might turn your friend onto their new favorite podcast. Make sure you're following the Van Flip on Twitter, at Van Flip Podcast. Actually, go ahead and tweet us right now. Let us know you're listening. Speaking of social media, make sure you follow Lambgoat as well. Give us a like on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram, at Lambgoat. Make sure you visit Lambgoat.com to stay up to date on news, releases, and announcements from around the hardcore and metal world. And if you enjoy watching podcasts rather than just listening to them, all these episodes and more content are available on the Lambgoat YouTube page. So make sure you head over there, give us a sub, and hit that alert bell so you always are notified when new episodes and content are uploaded. At this point, I want to shout out all of our Patreon supporters, JC, Alec, Jeff, Lachlan, and Dylan. Thanks for your continued support. I can't express how much your contributions help out the podcast. Speaking of Patreon supporters, starting this month, at the end of each month, we will do a random giveaway to one of our supporters. This month, we are giving away Internal Incarceration, the new album from Year of the Knife on vinyl. All Patreon supporters are already automatically entered, so head over to patreon.com/thevanflip to learn how you can help expand the podcast and win some free stuff. And one more announcement before I kick on the intro. I'd like to have a new theme intro, so if you have an idea for a new intro, hit us up at Vanflip Podcast on Twitter and let me know. On this episode of the podcast, we have Finn McKinty, or better known on YouTube as the Punk Rock NBA.
Oh yeah, what's this? I feel this. Oh yeah, this is fun. Oh no. Oh no.
Lambgoat presents the Van Flip Podcast.
All right, welcome back, or not welcome back, welcome to this episode of the Van Flip Podcast. This week we are lucky enough to be interviewing or have on the podcast Finn McKinty, who some of you may know from his earlier days as a writer, but most of you or the younger crowd may know him as the Punk Rock NBA on YouTube. He has a channel where he does weekly videos on a lot of topics that are scene-related or scene-issue-related and rock music or music related as well. He also does a podcast that he recently started in the last couple months, I believe, correct?
Yep, in January.
And that is slightly different than your punk rock, your NBA channel, the content wise, I would assume, right?
Yep. So on the YouTube channel, essentially what I do is dissect trends in music and kind of popular culture. So, you know, why did this band become popular? Why did this genre fall off? Things like that. So it's kind of more music fandom focused. You know, from my perspective is always going to be that of a business operator because that's just who I am. But the podcast is a little bit more focused specifically on business. So I do talk to some musicians, but also like YouTubers and entrepreneurs and, you know, graphic designers and people like that. So anybody who's found a way to turn their passion into their living is, you know, the kind of people that I would talk to on the podcast.
That is cool. I had a podcast prior to becoming the Lambgoat host. I had a podcast a couple of years ago, which oddly enough had a theme, an underlining theme of people who are making their passion their paycheck. So that's kind of cool too.
Yeah, it's hardly unique, but.
No, it's pretty unique. Obviously, I think a lot of that kind of content needs to be given to a lot more people, a wider audience, because, you know, that thought process and that mindset of making your passion a paycheck needs to be more widespread, I believe. But as Lambgoat's been around for quite some time, Finn, you've also been around for quite some time. You, maybe some of the guys, or not guys, but maybe some of the people that have been going to Lambgoat for a long time might remember you as Sergeant D from Stuff You Will Hate.
They might.
And that was kind of like, you were, explain to the viewers who may not know, what that website was about, but it was kind of like a satirical slash opinionated website where you would kind of.
Yeah, it's just a comedy blog I did about 10 years ago.
And is that basically like your jumping point into what progressed into the Punk Rock NBA after, you know, 10 years?
Well, I started doing fanzines in about 1993, I think, when I was like 15. So that was my first foray into what we now call content, which just means stuff, I guess, the content world. So I started making zines back then because at the time, you know, this was pre-internet as we know it. That's how you reached people. So I interviewed bands and, you know, did reviews and all that kind of stuff just because nobody was talking about the bands that I wanted to talk about. And I said, well, I guess I'll do it then. And I wouldn't say that I, you know, did it. It wasn't like the best thing in the world because I was a kid. But I did sell several thousand copies of them through the mail, which now that I think about it is that would be really intimidating for me to do. You know, I'm 16 years old going to the post office after school to ship some stuff to, you know, Sweden and, you know, Singapore and whatnot. Marketing this thing purely through the mail, which is crazy. Like the way it worked is that there were some big magazines like Maximum Rock and Roll was the big one and kind of the DIY punk and hardcore kind of world that would review every record and zine and anything else that came out. And so if you wanted to get attention on what you were doing, you would send it in to them to review. And so I did that and got a little bit of attention there. I don't actually know how big their circulation was. I would imagine probably in the like high tens of thousands, but I'm not sure. But, you know, I would do that and I'd, you know, then get, I don't know, a couple hundred orders or something for the zine. And I would just do that every time and word of mouth spread. And, you know, that's how it grew. So it's, you know, fundamentally the same thing, you know, I did the same thing there as anybody would do with a content venture now. It's like, what is the concept for the thing? How is it different? And then how do you get attention for it? And you do that by just finding out where the eyeballs are and then putting your thing in front of those eyeballs. So, you know, on YouTube, it's the, you know, the recommendation engine on YouTube is amazing because there's 2 billion users on YouTube. And if you get plugged into, you know, the holy grail of it would be to be in the top 5 on trending. You know, that's guaranteed tens of millions of views. I've never done that, but even just getting plugged into like the suggested videos on, you know, something popular can make you blow up, at least, you know, relatively speaking. For example, like I did a video about Ronnie Radke that I think was right around when he released Popular Monster, which was his most popular song. And my video was recommended on several of his songs. And so now that video has about 1 million views because I sort of was able to get my content in front of those eyeballs. So after I did zines, then I started blogging. The first stuff I did was like in the mid-2000s. I did a few that kind of never really went anywhere. Then I did one starting in 2008 with some friends of mine called Metal Inquisition, where we like talked about old metal stuff. Also wrote for Metal Sucks. I've written for like Substream and Terrorizer and some other magazines. And so, yeah, I mean, back in the mid-2000s, I did a kind of a hybrid magazine thing called Flow Multizine, which some of you may remember. It came in like a tall rectangular kind of box. It had a CD, a DVD, and a magazine with it. And we did about 120,000 copies of each of those. I think we did 13 or 14 issues maybe. Those were distributed free at independent record stores and skate shops all over the country. It was like a combination of like music and action sports stuff. And that was new because this is the mid-2000s and that DVD had a combination of like stuff that labels like Tooth & Nail worked with us a lot. They would pay to have one of their music videos on there and then we would produce the original video content. I produced all the original stuff on there as well as authored the DVD. So that's how I kind of got started making videos. Looking back at those now, you know, this is like 2004, 2005. They're absolutely horrible.
Cringeworthy.
yeah, I mean, it's just the technology back then was so rough. I mean, this is the mini DV days. If anybody remembers that, you know, you have to like, you had to transfer it in real time. So if I'd get 3 hours of footage from some surf company, you know, I'd be transferring footage for 3 hours in real time. And, yeah. You know, anyway, and the quality was terrible and all that stuff. But anyway, that's how I learned to make videos. So one way or another, I've been making, you know, content, quote unquote, you know, since I was like a child. And, you know, blogging is part of that. But at the end of the day, to me, it's like, it doesn't matter what the medium is. you know, I also started doing a podcast in like 2000. I've done two podcasts before this one, starting in like 2010. I did one when I worked at Creative Live. So, and then after that as well. So at the end of the day, the question is like, what are you saying that's different than what anybody else is saying? And then how do you get that in front of eyeballs who might potentially be interested in it? That's it. And I think that the medium you do it in is kind of less important than getting those two things right.
Yeah. And it's amazing that you said that kind of in the early days, like in the early 90s, how you were creating a physical zine, you know, pre-internet days and whatnot, to the numbers that you were saying, even a couple thousand, I mean, even a couple thousand now, as far as, you know, a physical publication would be insane to do, you know, DIY as well. So that's kind of like a pretty big feat, you know? And you grew up in the Northwest, right? Like in the Seattle area. Is that where you were kind of like peddling your zine when
yep.
you first started? And you were just kind of like, did you ever go to the grunge? Were you ever part of the grunge, push there in that time? Or were you always kind of attracted more towards like the quote unquote hardcore scene?
No, I thought all that grunge stuff was stupid. You know, that's the equivalent of like, you know, I'm trying to think of a good comparison for it now. That would be the equivalent of maybe like, you know, all those like Red State Butt Rock festivals, you know?
Gotcha.
And I'm not, you know, I'm not putting it down. It's just when I was 13, I'm like, I don't give a fuck about Soundgarden. That sounds like Led Zeppelin to me. I wanted to hear like, you know, the Circle Jerks and Sepultura, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought all that grunge stuff was very boring musically. Those people were also older than me, because especially back then, almost all the shows were 21 and over. So at least in like, in that kind of rock scene, there's just nothing about it appealed to me. Even now, I get it why it was significant culturally, and I can appreciate it now, intellectually, because it, you know, it was better than hair metal, I guess. but it was not appealing to me at all. I mean, it's not, yeah, it wasn't appealing to me at all. As a kid, I was around it. I remember all that. I remember Nirvana blowing up and all that, but it was just not interesting to me.
Agreed that there weren't that many kind of offshoots for heavier, you know, music at that time that were especially mainstream, like you have now. But it's interesting you say that, because I also like, I did like Nirvana. I was young enough to kind of remember when Nirvana kind of broke out. Because I'll be 37 next month, so mm-hmm. I have a couple years over a lot of people that are still into metalcore and whatnot. But yeah, I remember that coming out, and I remember liking Nirvana, but not liking it like everybody else did. And then, like you said, always wanting something a little heavier and whatnot. But so what did you kind of break your teeth on as far as like getting into the whole like metal and hardcore scene? What were you kind of like? I know you're a big Earth Crisis guy, so like, was that the start of it, or did you kind of? Well,
the first thing I saw was Suicidal Tendencies on MTV in 1989. They'd been banned from playing in LA for like 5 years or something because of like gang violence at their shows. Like, you know, the Suicidals were like an actual gang, and you know, I never went to any of those shows as a kid, but from talking to people who did, from what I understand, they're pretty rough. Suicidals are still around, by the way, as a gang. And anyway, so they were banned from playing LA, and there was a thing on MTV. It was like their first show in 5 years or whatever in LA. And I saw that, and I thought it was cool. I was, you know, 11 or 12 then, and I didn't really understand what it was, but I was like, whatever this is, it's cool. I'm in. And so then it was like my birthday, and so I had like, you know, $8 or whatever for my birthday. So I bought Lights, Camera, Revolution, and, you know, that's kind of what got me into it. And from there, I don't really remember what happened exactly after that, but just kind of all the stuff that you would, you know, expect someone to be into at that time, like, you know, Black Flag and mm-hmm. Descendants and the Accused and all that kind of stuff. And then when I discovered Maximum Rock and Roll in, I don't know, 92 or 93 or something, that was really the thing that got me into like the DIY punk and hardcore scene, which is, you know, kind of a different beast than, you know, metal and all that stuff. So that was kind of my gateway into all that. And, you know, they hated Earth Crisis and all the vegan straight edge stuff, but that's how I became aware of it. And then, you know, from there, it's just an endless rabbit hole of which corners of the weird world of hardcore you want to get into.
Yeah, I get that. Did you say that you were 11 and you were attending the show in LA? Is that what you said?
No.
Okay. I thought maybe, I was like, what are you doing traveling to LA? I think maybe you're on
Suicidal Tendencies was on MTV. There was a news article about how they were playing their first show in 5 years.
Gotcha. And you bought the album at 11. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. So you're kind of like, you do a lot of research and stuff like that for your videos. It seems like, cause you post a video every week, for your Punk Rock NBA channel, at least. And, what goes into like how deep do you guys dive? Do you guys do like the, you know, like how long do you spend getting information and do you, I mean, obviously you have a team of people currently, but when you first started off.
No, it's just me.
Oh, really? Cause I know you have like at least some people that help you with the podcast, correct?
Yeah, I have a Deanna Chapman who is fantastic. If you need help with the podcast, you should definitely call her. But yeah, she produces and edits the podcast. The videos are all me. I would love to outsource that. I'm not, you know, I'm very interested in outsourcing that. I'm not sure how possible that is, but I also don't want to be the person that's like, oh, I could never outsource what I do because it's so special and magical. You know, I think people who say that are oftentimes wrong. On the other hand, I don't want to potentially, you know, fuck anything up by outsourcing it in a way that wouldn't make sense. But to answer your question, I don't really do research. I mean, my videos are not history and they're not fact. They're opinion. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my videos are basically just my personal opinion. I might do a little bit of research just to be like, oh, where did this album actually chart on Billboard or something? Just minor fact checking, I would say. But I mean, they're not history. So I don't really do, you know, a lot of research or anything like that.
Interesting, because it does seem, I mean, you come off as a very knowledgeable person when you watch your videos.
I mean, I've been living this for 30 years, and I do it, and my job, you know, my jobs have been related to music for the past 7 or 8 years, so, you know, I absorb a lot. Like, if someone's been making pizza for 30 years, you know, they don't need to read a book about pizza, they just know a lot about pizza.
No, I get that, but it's a lot to retain over the years because there's so many different genres and there's so many different bands and you know, you touch on all these different topics, whether they're topics that someone of my age would care about or topics that of a younger crowd would also care about. So the way you do that is kind of, you finesse it very well, you know?
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I did notice that your biggest episode on your channel happens to be What Happened to Nu Metal. And,
yep.
You're not the biggest fan of nu metal, I would assume, right?
No, I don't really like it.
But it's crazy how those videos are the ones that become like your most popular. Like you said, I think the Rodney episode is the second in that line. But yeah, that was a great video. The nu metal video. I did come from a nu metal scene. That's kind of how I transitioned over into the hardcore scene. I eventually found Hatebreed at some point, but I grew up listening to Korn and Limp Bizkit. I'm from Jacksonville, so Limp Bizkit was like one of the hugest things to ever happen here.
Yeah, of course.
But you know, as an adult, I can look back on that time and I understand it for what it was. But like you said in that video, it was very quick, but it was influential. So, it was a fun little watch, that little video. So I appreciate that.
My channel doesn't, it's not about what I like or don't like. I don't really have strong, like, I don't listen to music that much. Like, I don't have strong opinions as a fan about music. Like, my opinion on almost any music is like, it's okay. You know, I don't have strong opinions about music at this point in my life, as far as a fan. You know, to me, I'm just looking at it as, I think of it the same way as like if you are an analyst, a stock analyst, you know, it doesn't matter whether you are a fan of shopping at American Eagle or not. Your job is to like, you know, do some analysis on American Eagle and tell, you know, your readers whether the stock is, you know, properly valued or not. And so that's kind of how I look at it. So it's irrelevant what I like and don't like. And in regards to nu metal, you know, yeah, it's not my favorite thing in the world, but it's certainly culturally very important. And, you know, for that reason, I think it's worth talking about.
Yeah, you definitely, you kind of opened my eyes a little bit to not suggesting or to not categorizing like bands like, Linkin Park, the Deftones and all that into the nu metal kind of cluster, even though like growing up in that I would have, but now looking back and seeing the trajectories that they have gone, you know, you kind of hit it on the head that they were associated with that crowd, but not necessarily a part of that crowd, obviously. So, they are very informative, and I would suggest if you haven't checked out Finn's Punk Rock NBA channel, that you'll find a lot out, and there's a lot of cool little nuggets on every little video that are very tantalizing. So it's a cool source of not news or fact, I should say, but opinion.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're good. So you kind of been doing marketing from the Jump Street. It sounds like you kind of marketed your zine. Was that something that you did in school too? Cause I know you moved out to Ohio, for a short period of time. Was that, for college, or was that like just a relocation situation?
Well, a little bit of both. I won't bore everyone with the details, but I did go to college in Cincinnati at the University of Cincinnati, originally for design, because they have like one of the best design programs of any public school in the country, or actually I would say even in the world. It's a fantastic school. So go Bearcats for anybody listening. After two or three, I guess 3 years, I switched out of that and ended up graduating with a degree in management and marketing. Because I realized that's kind of more where my, strengths and interests lie. I'm glad that I did get an education in design because it's super useful. I mean, I use it every day, and I think understanding design and marketing is something that, I mean, especially now in a world that's so like content driven, I think that's a great combination. I almost think that should be like should be some sort of an academic pathway, because like being able to understand the why and also the how is like, that's the magic combination. I mean, that's why influencers are as powerful as they are these days, because they understand both of those things. But yes, I've been doing marketing for a long time. While I was in college and a little bit after that, I worked for a product development company called Kaleidoscope in Cincinnati. We did a lot of stuff did industrial design and mechanical and electrical engineering. I did like kind of strategy stuff. So figuring out like what we should make and why. We worked for a bunch of different clients, but the things that I worked on most were for Procter & Gamble. So like Swiffer and Febreze, mm-hmm. which might sound kind of boring to people, but you know, these are billion-dollar brands that like, I mean, for example, I worked on, Bounce, the fabric softeners.
Yeah.
I worked on those, and at the time, they were doing like 400 million units a year of that, and that was a long time ago, so I would imagine now they're doing, you know, twice that or something. I have no idea, but, you know, working on anything where the scale is 400, is multiplied, whatever you do is multiplied by 400 million times a year, like working on anything at that scale is a cool challenge. So I learned a lot from working with them. I mean, it's just the most rigorous, like best marketing organization in the world, in my opinion. And so I'm really grateful that I got to do that. After that, I worked for Abercrombie & Fitch for about 4 years in design and marketing. At the time, we were rolling out a lot of stores in Europe, flagship stores in Europe and Asia. So worked on opening those in like Hong Kong and Shanghai and Brussels and Barcelona and wherever else. I don't know. We opened like 20 flagships or something in that time. And I also spent a lot of time in, China, Hong Kong, Indonesia, and Korea, going to factories there. I worked on the shopping bags, which again might sound kind of boring to people, but it's, you know, I don't remember how many millions we did a year, but it's millions of these things. And at that time, the Abercrombie shopping bag was a big deal. I mean, we all probably remember that. The one with the hunky guy over there, and getting the chance to, you know, go over to Asia and work with those factories to do quality assurance stuff was really cool to me as somebody with kind of an engineer brain. I enjoyed that a lot. And then after that, I worked for a company called Creative Live, which is an online education platform for creators and entrepreneurs, kind of focusing in particular on photographers. I did that for about 4 years as well. I started the music and audio part of that company, where I worked with some artists that you guys probably know about, like Converge and Periphery, mm-hmm. and Between yeah. the Buried and Me and Dillinger Escape Plan. After that, what I do now, I'm a partner in another online education company called URM Academy, which is, we call it the world's best online education for rock and metal producers. The partners in that are some people you guys might be familiar with, Joey Sturgis, A.L. Levy, and Joel Wanasek. So we've been going for about 5 years now, worked with pretty much everybody in rock and metal that you would care about, like Meshuggah, Gojira, Periphery, Lamb of God, Suicide Silence, I don't know, Bring Me the Horizon, Fall Out Boy. Yeah, I didn't remember. I mean, we pretty much had everybody on there. And so all that, the through line through, you know, those past two jobs is that my job is to make cash register ring. You know, my job is to grow the business. Which sounds, you know, maybe that sounds crass to people, but you know, business is business. Like revenue is oxygen for businesses. If you're not growing the top line, there's a problem, you know, and that's my job is to grow the top line. And I do have input on the operational stuff that affects the bottom line as well, but you know, primarily my job is to grow the top line, get more people in the door, monetize them better, and grow the business.
Yeah. And I also am somewhat obsessed with marketing and the why and how. And so, when you're talking about working with Febreze and Swiffer, that is very interesting. And I'm not going to dive too much into it here with, on the podcast, but it's interesting to figure out like, you know, why a consumer would buy one over the other and what would make the consumer buy one more than the other. But also, I mean, that logic then can be disseminated down to, you know, anything, whether it's your band yep. CD, your zine, your Instagram account, your anything. So, one of the things I would like to talk about with you on here would be because we do have a couple, not a couple, but we do have younger bands and members of bands that are younger that listen in on the podcast. So, you know, marketing and stuff like that could be difficult for, you know, a new band that has no idea, that's never, you know, done anything more so than playing their local club and everything like that. But what's the most important first step for like a younger, I don't want to say influencer type person, but a younger person that wants to kind of like break into, you know, the not electronic world, but the internet as far as like marketing themselves? Cause now it's so much more than just handing out flyers in front of your show or in front of other shows. Like, it was when I was a kid, we would just market that way and the internet wasn't as prevalent. So like, what would be the best first step for someone to like, you know, step out there?
Well, the first thing I would do is like get your mindset in the right place. Like every moment of every day is a constant cycle of test, measure, learn, repeat. I mean, that's what you're doing with everything you do every day is like, I posted this today. How did it perform? Why did it perform that way? What did I learn about that I can incorporate into the next thing I post? So that's the main thing. Like if you are approaching it with that kind of an engineer mindset, you'll be fine because, you know, understand that it's going to take a while, most likely, unless you are really lucky or really freakishly good, which most of us aren't. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a while for you to get traction on whatever you're doing, and that's okay. As long as you go into it with that mindset, you will eventually find something that works. You just have to be, you know, willing to adapt and change and, you know, learn from what works and double down on what does. And as long as you go into it with that mindset, you'll find it. aside from that, I would say that, you know, consistency is also super, super important with a lot of, you know, creative types. They are generally not so good at consistency. You know, they maybe, you know, you see this a lot, like with podcasts. Someone's really excited about their new podcast. They do like 4 episodes and then, you know, like, oh wow, this is a lot harder than I thought. And, you know, I'm out of ideas. And then they don't do another one for like 2 months and then they do 3 more and then they do another one for 2 months. And it's like, that's not how you build a business. And you got to understand that what you're doing here is building a business. Whether you want to look at it that way or not, that's what it is, because you're asking for people for their time and money. And as soon as you're asking people for something, then it's business. And consistency is super important. You also got to ask yourself, how are you different? What are you doing or saying that's different from everybody else? So if you are, for example, you know, you see a lot of people that want to be influencers just post a picture of themselves in front of some fancy car. There's nothing here. Like, how is this different or interesting? Like, you're not adding, at the end of the day, any content you make has to make your audience's life better in some way, whether that is making them laugh or entertaining them or inspiring them or educating them on something. You got to add value to your audience in some way or another, and it's got to be different. It doesn't have to be like night and day different, but there has to be something that's just at least a little bit different. So, for example, for a band, you know, if you're posting just the same bland pictures of, you know, your band playing live, that could be any band anywhere, why would anybody care about that? And I don't mean that in a, you know, that's another question you should be asking yourself a lot, is why would anybody care about this? And I don't mean that in a like harsh, you know, judgmental way. I mean, just that's the world we live in, is that people are not short on options for how to spend their attention, right? I mean, you got to remember, you're competing against not just other bands or creators, you're competing against Netflix and YouTube and TikTok and Xbox and Steam and whatever else people, and podcasts and like whatever else people could be doing to spend their time. That's what you're competing against. And free, just because something doesn't cost money, that doesn't mean it's free. You're still asking someone to spend their time. And I would argue that for a lot of people, asking someone to spend 5 minutes of their time is a bigger ask than it is. I mean, 5 minutes, that's an eternity.
On the internet, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, like when was the last time you listened to an entire 5 minute song without doing something else?
Yeah, I totally understand that. And a lot of that has to do with the way that people have obviously ingested content in the last couple of years. You know, attention spans are just shorter far as stuff goes. But it's crazy that also happened, but long-form YouTube content is also becoming more popular now. So
yes,
it's crazy.
Yes, I mean, that's actually a great point. I think people have maybe evolved their thinking on this, but maybe not. There's this idea that everything has to be short. That's not true. I mean, as you said, like there's plenty of like 20, 30 hour long videos with hundreds of thousands of views on YouTube, you know, or how many games? Look at like how fucking long is Red Dead Redemption, you know, or two? Like that's what, like a 100 hour game?
Yeah.
And how many people played that for 20, 40, 80 hours? Millions, tens of millions.
And a lot of people watch people playing it for
years. Exactly. That's a great point. That is a great point for like hours. So the idea that everything has to be short is not true. But there does have to be something about it that's compelling. And one thing I would say in particular that is relevant to musicians, creators of any kind, but you got to open with a bang. You got to do something that's going to get them noticed, that's going to grab their attention right off the bat. Unless, you know, if you're Slipknot or something like that, you have earned the right to kind of experiment a little bit and ask more of your audience. But if you're a small creator, focus on the first, like, literally 3 seconds of whatever you're putting out. If it's like a video or a song, like I use Lil Pump as an example of this all the time. You know, you may not like his music, but if you listen to like Gucci Gang, there's a reason why that song got so popular, is because it just immediately goes into the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much every line in the song is a hook.
Yeah. It's pretty simple as well. Like it's not hard to remember.
Exactly. And the same applies for videos. Like if you watch my videos, I always open with some sort of like, I'll clip out like 5 or 10 seconds of something in the video that's either funny or controversial or something like that at the very beginning of the video to immediately grab your attention, and then get you, you know, to pay attention to the rest of the video. I think of it like, a cold open in a movie. Like, you know, a lot of these action movies, you think about it, like imagine the first scene of the movie is some wild, crazy gunfight. And you don't know who's who and why they're shooting each other and all that. But there's people shooting each other. There's action. It grabs your attention. And then, like, the guy gets hit in the head with a baseball bat, blacks out, wakes up, and then they explain, you know, what was happening.
Yeah.
But they grabbed your attention with that gunfight at the beginning of the movie and then backed into explaining what was happening. So I think there's something to learn there. And that's true even if it's like still images or something like that. You still have to ask yourself, like, how am I going to like stop them? You put yourself in the user's shoes. Imagine they're scrolling through Instagram or TikTok or whatever. What are you going to do that's going to stop them from scrolling past your shit? You know, that could be some sort of a really compelling headline or a caption or some funny shit in the image, whatever. But if you're a local band and it's just some picture of you guys rocking out to 18 people at your local club, nobody's going to give a shit. And I don't mean to be that. I don't mean that to be like Debbie Downer. It's just like, don't do that. There's something else you can do that they will care about. And I don't know what that is. That's your job to find that. It depends on who you are. I mean, I don't know. There's no one size solution that fits everybody. That's why it's hard. But you got to be different. You got to do something that is going to catch their attention. And attention is the name of the game. Think about it that way. Like, nobody will listen to your music or listen to your podcast or watch your videos until you are able to get their attention. So you have to, like, look at your job first and foremost as the ability to get people's attention and then retain it. You don't get to do any of the other stuff. You know, it's like, think of it like the dessert is people listening to your music, but you don't get to eat dessert until you eat your vegetables first. The vegetables is getting them to pay attention.
Yeah. How can you have pudding if you don't have your meat?
Exactly. You can't just eat pudding for dinner.
It is kind of crazy. Like, I would, you know, honestly, I don't know if I would enjoy starting a band or being in a band currently right now with just all the other kinds of competition you have, like you were saying earlier. It's not just other bands, whether it be in your area, but it's also bands all over the internet. And then again, it's also where people are pointing their attention at. And there's a lot to juggle. You know what I mean? There's a lot to juggle as far as, even if you're just thinking of just the social media marketing aspect. I mean, you have so many different platforms. You know, which demographic are you pointing towards? Does your demographic use Instagram? Do they use TikTok? Do they use Facebook?
Right.
You know, so it's so much to think of. Do you see younger bands using different platforms than, say, like older established bands?
Not really. I would say that musicians in general are really bad at marketing and technology. So a lot of them are still into Facebook, which I think is, I mean, you know, if you're getting the results you want out of Facebook, then great. You know, going back to what I said before, it's like test, measure, learn, repeat. If you are killing it on Facebook and you're happy with the results you're getting, then great, keep doing it. But if you keep doing the same thing on Facebook all the time and it's not working, then you need to ask, you need to kind of take a step back and deconstruct the problem. What are we doing? What platform are we doing it on? Then you sort of test things. Again, use your engineer mindset. Like, why don't you try posting the same thing on, you know, Instagram and see if you get better results? Because then, you know, maybe the platform is the issue. Or try, you know, different content. Like, just, you got to just test stuff and try to figure out what's up. I would say that, you know, 99% of the time, if you have something interesting to say, and if there's something like fundamentally different and interesting about what you're doing, it will work on any platform, you know, to some extent or another. There are details that matter. There are certain things that, you know, work better than others. But for example, TikTok is a good example of this. People repost TikToks all the time on Facebook and Instagram, and they do great. So the content itself, the funny, like with TikTok, most of them are funny. The joke is what's important. Whether you tell it on TikTok or Instagram or Twitter or Facebook is less important. You know, again, there are details that matter. Like, if you are really good, you know, if you're really good at writing witty one-liners, but you're really awkward on camera, then maybe Twitter is better for you than Instagram. But worry less about the platform and worry more about what you're saying.
Interesting. And just to touch back on the URM Academy, what is that? Because it says on your Wikipedia page that you do a lot of multi-tracks from albums. Is that just something that, like, if you're a student at the academy, you have the ability to, like, say, listen to the guitar tracks only or the drum tracks only of certain songs? Or is it about, yep, like mastering and mixing and mastering? Or
All the above. Oh, so cool. our main program is called Nail the Mix. The way that works is that each month we get a different mixer on to mix a song by one of your favorite bands, like I mentioned. So, for example, this month we have a band called Loathe on. I don't know if you're familiar with them. Kind
of,
oh,
yeah,
we've
had
new...
them on the podcast. Kadeem, yeah, and the boys in the UK, they're like the new Deftones. They're great.
Exactly. So we've got Loathe. It's a song by Loathe being mixed by a guy named George Lieber, who's a fantastic, like, up-and-coming kind of mixer out of the UK. So the way it works is when you sign up, you get the raw multi-track files for the song. Like, these are literally the exact same files that the mixer used to mix the song on the album. For better or for worse, sometimes there's stuff that's fucked up about them. Sometimes they're beautiful and pristine, but, you know, you get exactly what he used on the album, and you can drop that into your software and mix it and do whatever you want with it to learn from it. And then at the end of the month, the producer comes on and does a live stream where they walk you through exactly how they did it on the album and answers your questions live on air. So then you can kind of compare your work to theirs. And there's a lot of other, you know, so you can, and you can say like, well, I had a really hard time, you know, EQing the fizz out of the guitars on here without making them like all muddy and gross. How did you do that? And he would say, oh, great question. Well, here's how I dealt with that on the album. There's a lot of other stuff to do. Like we have a mix contest and there's like a very, very active Facebook group with like 4,000 or 5,000 people from all over the world answering questions and interacting with each other and stuff. But the core of it is that sort of monthly thing of every month there's a new mixer, new band, you get the raw multi-tracks, and then they show you how to mix it, they show you how they mixed it at the end of the month.
Interesting. Yeah. Right when you started talking about it, I was like, I have definitely seen the Kurt Ballou thing floating around where they nail the mix. Yeah, I've definitely seen that. So are you big into like mixing and engineering, or do you just prefer the marketing and the background on that at the school?
I don't really do it anymore just because I don't have time. But yeah, I was definitely into like, you know, recording my own music and stuff for quite a while. It's fun. I like it. I just don't have, you know, there's a lot of things I would like to do that I just don't have time to do anymore. And that's one of them, but you know, I definitely know a lot about it. I'm certainly passionate about it as a craft. And more so than getting better at it myself, what I'm passionate about is, I mean, I don't suck, but I'm not great. I'm never going to be the greatest, but I'm decent. But what I'm really passionate about is helping other people get better at their craft, you know, because that's sort of like, because I care about the craft of like production, I can actually have a much greater impact by helping thousands of people all over the world get better at it than just getting better at it myself. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So what was the,
and I would say like we, meaning me and Al in particular, but all of us, but like we really have changed the way that people learn how to produce music. Cause back in 2013 at Creative Live, I did the very first like live streaming, you know, mixing education course as we think of them now. Like lots of people do that now, but Al and I did that in 2013. Like that was way before anybody else did it.
Yeah.
And since then lots of people have done it. You know, I'd say, you know, URM Academy kind of picked up where Creative Live left off. I think we learned a lot from that, but you know, what we're doing now is better than what we did at Creative Live. But you know, it's cool to see that. Like we really have made a difference. We've had tens of thousands of people all over the world like learn from us. And I don't think it'll, you know, ever go back to what it was before where, you know, you had to pay a whole bunch of money to go someplace like Full Sail, you know, and intern for some fucking asshole that's gonna treat you like shit. You know, in exchange for teaching you his secrets, and just none of that stuff happens anymore. The culture is different now. Like it used to be that, you know, people held their mixing secrets really close to their chest and they didn't want to tell anybody how they did this. Oh, this is my secret trick. And that's all gone now. People aren't like that. Like now people are very eager to share because they understand that if you're good at what you do, like sharing your knowledge will only help you. It's not going to create like a legion of competitors that are going to eat your lunch. And if it does, well, then I guess you weren't that special to begin with. So I think people are learning to see things differently, and it's gratifying to see that we've really, you know, we really have changed things.
Well, and something you kind of touched on in your videos, gatekeeping, that seems to be that seems to be fading more and more as we progress in time.
Yeah.
So much so that I'm free to say that I listened and still listen to nu metal without fear of repercussions or anything like
totally.
That. But I definitely was one of those kids, you know, back in the day, in your Haley video that you just recently posted, you know, I was one of the hardcore kids that couldn't really say that, oh yeah, I listened to Taking Back Sunday and Paramore and all that stuff. So it's cool that we've kind of not grown up to the point where we can do that. So how did you kind of start dabbling on YouTube? Like what made you decide, okay, I'm going to set up a camera here and I'm just going to give my opinion that no one's going to care about to the world?
Right. Well, I mean, it's the same thing that made me start a zine and start blogging. Like essentially I want to be wherever the attention is. And in 1993, that was making a magazine. In 2005, that was blogging. And now, I mean, I started the channel in 2017, which I consider kind of late, but, you know, YouTube was the name of the game then. So I said, well, if that's where the attention is, then I'm going to give it a try. And I don't consider myself great at making videos. you know, on a technical sense, like I'm not, there's lots and lots and lots of people that know more about video production than I do, because I don't find it enjoyable. But again, going back to what I was saying about marketing in general, it's like, it's about the idea. Like there are lots and lots of people that make way better looking videos than I do that get no views, and it's because they're not saying something. Mm-hmm. And I'm not putting them down or anything like that. It's just that for whatever reason, people tend to get very fixated on production over the actual content. And I think that's a big miss. And I learned that lesson a long time ago. I'm also not the greatest writer in the world. There's lots and lots of people who are far better at the craft of writing than I am. And yet I've had, I don't know, dozens and dozens of things published in international magazines and written thousands of blog posts that have gotten millions and millions of views because, you know, I've always focused on trying to say something rather than, you know, impressing a bunch of MFAs with the clever turn of phrase that I used.
Interesting. It's crazy you say you're not a good writer because I also think that I'm not a good writer and I've never once claimed to be a writer. But with so much, I mean, you have, like you said, you have so much out there already that's written. And do you write a script for your videos or do you just kind of turn the camera on and then edit everything later?
No, I write a script for all of them. Because for those videos, because typically what I'm saying is fairly challenging, it's important to me to get the specifics to communicate my point in exactly the right way, because you know how it is if you make the slightest mistake, people are going to jump on your shit about it. And, so I want to have the closest thing I can to like an airtight, bulletproof argument that I've put out there. And so for that reason, I like to write a script. You know, it's possible that I maybe don't need to do that part. I don't know. But I feel like if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I'm pretty sure that if I didn't do that, there'd be something that I would fuck up. And then all the comments would be like, well, actually, blah, blah, blah. And I'd be like, oh, fuck, I can't believe I didn't say that. So I always try to like sort of recognize what any of the objections might be to what I'm saying. A lot of which are valid, some of which aren't, but recognize what those objections are and do my best to knock them down before they even come up.
Interesting. Yeah, it's there's a lot that goes into not only preparation for like these episodes or your episodes that you have on your podcast or your channel, but yeah, it's always easier after the fact 2020 of another person commenting saying like, why didn't you talk about this, this, or this? I mean, if you don't have a script or bullet points lined out, and admittedly, most of the podcasts that I tend to do, I try to limit a lot of that. I do some research the day or two before to kind of, you know, not be completely oblivious to everything. But even if I'm really familiar with the band or the person, there are going to be things that in the moment I'm not thinking of right then and there. And, you know, I also try to, you know, talk about other things that most people may not talk about with that person. So yeah, there's a lot of comments sometimes where like, you didn't talk about XXX or this is this. And I'm like, oh man, dude, and part of it is I really wish I could have, you know, there are people that right. I wished I could have brought up everything with, but you know, it is what it is. But you've done your,
yeah, podcast's a little bit different too. That's a conversation. You're not necessarily trying to, it's not persuasive communication, which is what I do. Like in high school, I forgot to mention this, but in high school, I was on the debate team for like 3 years and I took it really seriously. I mean, I went to like debate camp and I did tournaments every weekend and stuff like that. And so I look at what I'm doing basically as like persuasive communication. I'm trying to persuade people that my point of view on this is correct. And a podcast is a little bit of a different thing. So I don't think I don't think you have to clear the same kind of hurdle there that you do with like an essay.
Oh, definitely. Because I also do rely on another party. And sometimes I also have, Alex from Lamb with me. So
right.
He shoulders some of the weight. Are you still over in the Northwest now or do you live in,
mm-hmm.
Okay. How have you been dealing with this whole pandemic situation? As an internet creator, I'm sure that you've taken, you know, a lot of that time to create content and be more consistent. Not that you weren't already, but when you were talking about consistency, I thought maybe you were kind of jabbing at me because I also do go like a month.
Oh, no, I'm not jabbing at anyone.
Oh, no, 100%. I was just making a joke, but I do go like a month without uploading a podcast, and it's I do notice that it definitely goes in a big dip when that happens, and then if I'm killing it for a couple of months, then we're up there. But so how have you been doing during this pandemic? Have you just been kind of like holed up and just in your quarantine house and creating?
Well,
content?
I mean, it's business for me, business as usual for me, because URM Academy has been a fully distributed company from the beginning. You know, we've got people in Atlanta, Michigan, LA, Chicago, like we're all over the place, and we just do everything by Slack and Zoom and iMessage and stuff. So this didn't affect us at all, which is awesome. I mean, we designed the company that way for a reason, because we wanted to be robust against things like this, and it was, and keep our costs low. So that was normal, didn't change anything for us. For me personally, I've always worked from home anyway, so doesn't change anything for me either. The only difference is now, my wife is here and working from home too. And, she works for Amazon and they're all working from home. And, obviously with Amazon being as technology savvy as it is, like that wasn't, a tremendous shift for them either. So, I feel very lucky that it's business as usual for us. We live up in a suburb, by Lake Washington. If anybody's familiar with the area, we live up near the very top of Lake Washington. So, it's not the woods exactly, but we live near a lot of stuff that I can go walk to. And, I find it nice. There's no traffic. The only thing that really has changed for me is our jiu-jitsu academy is closed. But we'll go over to someone's house and just like roll in small groups or something like that. So, I'm even getting my jiu-jitsu fix in. So really hasn't changed anything for me. And I'm very grateful for that. But I also should give myself credit as I've designed my life, like I said, to be robust against things like this. Cause I got hit pretty hard by the last few recessions, like the dot-com bust, bubble bursting in 99. And then 9/11, that both of those really took the wind out of my sails with things I was trying to do at my career at the time. The one in 2009, fortunately, that was like right when I was graduating from college. So it didn't really, 2008, 2009, didn't really affect me too much. I was kind of lucky there. But I've gotten kicked in the balls by these things a couple times. And so I wanted to design a life that didn't depend on, the world to keep existing in its current form as much as possible. So, things that happen on the internet, passive income, stuff like that. I don't want to have to rely on travel or an office or any of that kind of expensive stuff. So I do want to give myself a little bit of credit for, kind of having the foresight to expect to be kicked in the balls by life again.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm not putting down anybody who was kind of taken by surprise by this, because I mean, how can anybody predict this? So I don't mean to like say, oh, I told you so or anything like that. I feel terrible for all the people who are affected by this.
No, of course. But it is going, I think what's going on currently is opening up a lot of people's eyes to the fact that, I mean, growing up as a teenager and stuff like that, I was told a lot that like, obviously music was my biggest passion. And when I was younger in the, 14 to 16, I started my own music blog. It was more so based around like new metal, but then again, mm-hmm. it blossomed into like hardcore and metal. And, I had that for about 5-6 years, when I was a teenager. And of course I spent a lot of time stealing news from like Lambgoat and the PRP and other news organizations, or media outlets at the time. But, no one told me that, hey, you might be able to, like, do something with this. And so I think a lot of the things that are going on now is showing, like, oh, wow, I don't have to go the traditional route, whatever that may be for that person. You can do whatever you want. And like you were saying earlier, if you're making content and you're marketing it right, at some point you will find an audience. It's just, can you withhold the time until you find the audience, can you be consistent? Can you make it, interesting? And can you, like what will help you find that audience, So it's cool that that's going on. And it's cool that a lot of bands and a lot of other organizations and outlets are adapting to that. Like, we're doing Skype podcasts now, obviously. When we started it, it was a goal of mine to do them as much in person as I could. But of course, once the show stopped happening, you know, you gotta.
In person is definitely better, but you know, these Skype ones are pretty good too.
Well, it definitely opens the door up more. You know, like I had like Kadeem from Loathe on a couple of weeks ago, months ago or whatever, and you know, he's from the UK. So, you know, would we have been able to do that in time? Probably, but you know, who knows whenever they'll be over here. And speaking of the pandemic and, you know, the music scene and stuff like that, how do you think things will be going forward for that? Like shows, will you see like live shows on the internet more? I think that used to be looked down upon. Live streaming was looked down upon for the most part in the beginning, but now it's become like this giant thing of positivity for any artist or influencer that is using it.
In regards to live streaming in particular, I'm pretty skeptical. I don't think it's fundamentally the same. Like if you think about the what are you paying for when you go to a show? It's not just, you know, watching the band on stage. It's not just the visual part of it. I mean, it's an experience in general that you're paying for. I think that there's some of these bands are getting, you know, a little bit of success with that, and that's great. I'm happy for them, but I don't think that's going to last. You know, the idea that you're just going to be able to like, oh, well, now we'll just live stream everything and it's going to be hunky dory, I think is not true. There may be a few people where that's true for them, and that's great. But I think it's, you know, revealing a couple things. One, live events is a terrible business. It always has been and it always will be for a lot of reasons. For one, because there's a lot of risk. For two, because it creates zero recurring revenue. So it's a, you got to get right back on that treadmill. As soon as this show is done, you're right back at zero and you got to get right back on that treadmill.
Are you talking about bands and artists, or are you talking about like the industry as a whole?
Live events in general. Okay. I mean, it's fundamentally just a bad business. I mean, there's a reason why no investor will touch a live, no like reputable like venture investor will touch a live events business for this reason. It's just fundamentally a bad business. And I mean, if people like playing shows and like going to shows, like that's fine. I understand that, but this is exposing exactly why it's a bad business. Because if your company depends on the ability to put on live events, what happens if you can't put on live events? You're done. As compared to, you know, any company, like a software company, that relies on subscriptions, you're good. So there's a lot more risk, and there's no recurring revenue. And so for those reasons, I think that people are going to have to wake up to the fact that live events is an awful business. I don't think those are going to come back anytime soon. And even if they do, I mean, they're going to come back eventually, but you just got to get out of the idea that live events are such an important thing. I mean, they're just not. I mean, or they shouldn't be. You know, if you've created a business that relies on you traveling 200 days a year, are you going to do that for the rest of your life?
Yeah, agreed.
You know, when you have like a family or you're old, like what are you going to do? This is not sustainable.
Yeah, I think a lot of the what a lot of bands probably, you know, came into touring just to get out there, you know, to get their name out there. Because again, the internet wasn't as prevalent, yada, yada, yada. You know, getting on shows is going to be the better way to expose your band to more people. But I also don't know where the live stream thing's going to go. I mean, I did watch Between the Buried and Me's live stream they recently did of their Colors album. I did not watch the Under Oath one, though, because it was $15, you know, to gain access to the
which is a lot
to the show, and of course it is a lot. You know, I would definitely,
but it's not a lot to it's not a lot to go see them live, right?
No, that's person. I was going to say,
and that shows you what is the relative value of the part of watching the band perform. It's not that high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
no, you're paying for a lot more than just that.
And there's a lot more that goes into the live show too. Whether you're in the front row, in the pit, or in the back, I mean, there's so many other things that go along with. You know, you have the ability to buy merch, which a lot of people
see your friends,
socialize.
It feels different, like the sound waves hitting you.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
And the venue feel different.
It's as cool as it was, I will say, to watch the Colors stream. I mean, Between the Buried Me is one of my favorite bands, so of course. I
love those guys as human beings, so I want to be clear. I'm entirely supportive of what they're doing. I don't want it to sound at all like I'm talking shit on it. I want them to be successful. I just don't think that this is long-term a substitute for, you know, for playing shows. I think bands need to figure out. Ronnie Radke is a good example. This guy is making probably somewhere around $100,000 a month on Twitch.
Yeah, streaming. Yeah, a lot of people stream.
You got to figure something else out. You got to think of yourself. In my opinion, they need to think of themselves as like influencers who happen to also make music. And think about what all the other things, what other things do influencers do? For example, like in the beauty space, there's so many of these like beauty YouTubers or influencers that have like a, you know, eyeshadow palette or whatever. Yeah. You have an audience. How do you monetize that? One, you know, you could use that to start other ventures. You could do some sort of affiliate marketing. Like there's a million things you can do. You just have to, like, if you have created a business that relies on traveling, on touring hundreds of days a year, I just think that's a bad idea. And, yeah. And what the answer, you know, what kind of business model you should build, I don't have the answer to that. Again, there's no one size fits all model. but, you know, I would look to bands like Periphery and Dance Gavin Dance and The Main as good examples of bands that are not huge. Those aren't huge bands. But they do very well for themselves because they have a super deep relationship with their fans and they have monetized them in lots of different ways.
Yeah, I think I was talking with Chris from Attila I've talked about it on this podcast many times and before the pandemic hit that, you know, when Patreon came out or whatnot, you know, in my head, I was like, man, this is a really great way for other kind of acts, whether it's bands, pop, metal, you know, reggae, rap, whatever. This is a great way for people to support their artists that they actually do love rather than going to a show or buying merch. Cause I mean, at the most point, that seemed to be the way that you could really benefit the band you were seeing was to go to their live show and buy their merch. Obviously, cause the record sales weren't going to necessarily get back to their pocket for the most part, but
yeah,
I thought early on that bands were missing out by not doing any of that, and you know
they are.
I would hear a lot of people's pushback on that with, you know, like selling out or it seems cheesy.
Fine.
Blah blah blah.
Then fine, then hold your. I don't give a fuck if you want to fucking stop your own bag, then do it. I don't care.
Yeah, like Frankie from Immure tried to do the fan club. You know, a couple months ago or whatever prior to the pandemic. And now, you know, so many bands have a fan club that they have a reoccurring subscription with, whether it be on Twitch or
recurring revenue. That is the best thing in the world. You don't, if you've never run a business with recurring revenue, you don't know how great it is.
Yeah.
Like, trust me. Like, so for example, with like URM Academy, you know, we have several thousand paying members all over the world. And on any given month, you know, we typically grow a little bit, but there's been some times where we've shrunk a little bit. But it's not going to go away overnight. We might lose a couple hundred people at most in a month. And, you know, that's not good, but it doesn't go to zero.
Yeah.
Like, there's no scenario in which we're going to go to zero next month. It's not going to happen. I know that no matter what, we're going to have several thousand people who are going to stay members next month. And that makes life so much easier instead of going, ah, shit, if I don't book a tour by September, I make $0.
Yeah. And not saying that people forget that they're subscribed to your Patreon or Twitch, but that does happen.
I'm sure they do.
That does happen.
I mean, I don't want them to. I'm not saying like I want them to forget, but like that does happen for sure.
Yeah. I mean,
just like a gym membership.
Of course, yeah, of course. They're easier to get out of, though. Easier to cancel. Well, I could spend all day on here with you talking about marketing and social media stuff because, I mean, again, I can nerd out on that all day long, so, but I won't for our listeners and viewers. But to wrap this up, you have a YouTube channel with almost 250,000 subscribers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is the end goal for you as far as the punk rock NBA goes? Like, what's your ideal situation? Or are you already at your ideal situation?
Well, I have nothing to complain about. Like, everything is in a great place. So I'm happy where I'm at. But I think you always have to be thinking about what's next because, you know, life has a way. As the world found out this spring, life has a way of throwing curveballs at you, so I think you always need to be asking yourself what's next. What I have been focused on in the past couple of months is building up my social media coaching program, where I help people figure out how to tell their story online, build their audience, and turn that into some sort of business results. So if you want to be a full-time creator, or if you're like the founder or CEO of a business that wants to grow your own personal brand as a way of growing your company, that's what I help you do. I don't expect that YouTube will last forever. I hope it does, but you know, these things tend to not last forever. Eventually people will probably stop caring what I have to say about music, but if it doesn't, that's great. But what I hope is that, you know, in the next couple of years, I can build that coaching business up to the point where, you know, I half jokingly say that my big audacious goal is to get Amazon to pay me $1 million to help them do a better job of talking about AWS than they do, because, you know, that company should be setting the conversation around cloud computing on a daily basis, and they're kind of not. Like, if you look at their YouTube channel, for example, their videos literally get like 275 views, and it's fucking AWS.
Like,
yeah, it should not be happening. They're not good at telling stories online, and they should be. So I want them to pay me $1 million to help them figure out how to do it. You know, they're making what, something like $5 billion a quarter in profit now.
I mean, they've got the budget for sure.
Yeah, so for them to throw me $1 million, and you know, if that makes the tiniest incremental dent in their business, then that was the best money they ever spent.
Well, if that's not a way of manifesting your future, I don't know what else is, right? If you put it out there, you might be able
exactly.
to get it. Yeah. Well,
exactly.
It's been great.
So if Andy Jassy's listening, you know where to find me.
At Finn McKenty, or is it at the Punk Rock
That's
NBA?
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's been great having you on, Finn. I hope we can have you on again at some point. Again, if you're not familiar with Finn, he has the YouTube channel, the Punk Rock NBA. He loads of videos on there with great information as well as some opinion. And before we cut you off here, what newer bands, whether they be hard rock, hardcore, metal, metalcore, whichever band, are you listening to any new bands currently?
Bands, not a ton. But I listen to, I mean, the most exciting stuff to me right now is happening in, I guess, what you would call alternative rap. Like, probably my favorite current artist, like newer artist, is City Morgue. I don't know if you're familiar with them. I guess you would call them trap metal.
Okay.
But they just came out with a new album, which is pretty great. I like everything they've ever done. But yeah, I mean, City Morgue is probably my favorite. I also like Lil Lotus a lot, who's a new, like, kind of, or not new, but he is an alternative or quote unquote emo rapper that signed to Epitaph recently. He's been around for a while, but he just put out a bunch of new stuff. So I would say those are probably my two favorite newer artists in the world of alternative music. I also listen to a lot of like pop and like Walmart country. I mean, I listen to everything, you know?
Yeah. Well, again, now that gatekeeping is kind of a thing of the past, I also listen to a lot of other things too. So I find myself currently listening to a lot more hardcore and metal than I used to in the past. I used to make electronic music, DJ electronic music. I grew up listening to pop and hip hop. So when I found heavy metal and in the form of Limp Bizkit's first album, you know,
yeah.
that kind of infused rock and rap in a way that I'd never seen before. So of course I became a big fanboy, but yeah, I do listen to a lot of other things, but in the last couple of years, I've kind of gotten more back into the hardcore and metal, at least with the new releases, especially with this. You have to stay up to date some way, you know? So there's so many bands and so many things coming out at all hours of the day.
Cool. Well, there's, yeah, I mean, that's a good problem to have. There's more good stuff coming out than you could ever possibly consume.
Yeah, you're completely correct. And now that it is unfortunately raining and I can hear it in my headphones, I don't know if you can hear it, but
yes, I can.
Okay, I'm in Florida, so you know it rains every damn afternoon, and here we are, like clockwork, at 1 o'clock. It's raining.
Yes.
You know, I was thinking maybe you'd be the one in the rain, but it turns out I am.
Florida is rain central, not here.
Thunderstorm central for sure. Yeah. Well, Finn, it was great having you on. A lot of knowledge was dropped today. I hope a lot of younger bands and younger individuals who wish to get out there take that to heart. Maybe they go and, you know, check out your podcast. I noticed you just had Tommy Rogers on from Between the Buried Me, so that
yep.
was great. He's a great guy. But yeah, in your informative podcast, I know you do a lot of things that are on the business side. So hopefully someone takes notice of that and it helps somebody along the way. And again, thanks for jumping on the Lamb Goat podcast, Ben. It was great to have you.
Anytime. Thanks for having me. See ya.
See ya.
Hello, Tom May here, host of Future Friday. I've spent the last 15 years on the road with my band, The Menzingers, where I've met all kinds of wild and fascinating people. So I started a podcast. On Future Friday, I talk to fellow musicians about the moments that made them, their passions outside of music, and the curiosities that tie us all together. I've also talked to the likes of UFO researchers, magicians, soldiers, and documentary filmmakers, and I'm constantly searching for folks that can shape and change our view of the world. You can check out Future Friday wherever you like.